The Gateless Barrier, Case 3. Whenever Juju was asked a question, he simply raised one finger. One day a visitor asked Juju's attendant, "What has Master preached?" The boy raised a finger. Hearing of this, Juju cut off the boy's finger with a knife. As he ran from the room, screaming with pain, Juju called to him. When he turned his head, Juju raised a finger. The boy was suddenly enlightened. When Juju was about to die, he said to his assembled monks, "I received this one finger Zen from Tianlong. I used it all my life, but never used it up." With this, he entered into his eternal rest. Women's comment. The enlightenment of Juju and the boy has nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Tianlong, Juju, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with a single skewer. Women's verse. Tianlong made a fool of old Juju, who cut the boy with a sharp blade. Just as the deity Juling raised his hand, and Huaishan, with its many ridges, split in two. Please sit comfortably. The story of Juju, or Gute in Japanese, and his one-fingered Zen that appears in Case 3 of The Gateless Barrier is one of the best known and often discussed cases. Eiken Roshi tells us that Yasutani Roshi was particularly fond of this koan, and yet relatively little is known about the protagonist, Juju. We know that he lived about the same time as Linji and Huangpo, whom we talked about the other day, that is, around the 9th century, and that he was a descendant in the 5th generation of Matsu. But we don't have either his birth or death dates, and we don't even know his real name or his surname. Juju was his nickname, taken from the title of a dharani, or an incantation, called the Juju Formushin, that he habitually chanted. And Juju is actually a term that's used in Buddhism to represent a very large number. It's sometimes translated as 10 million. So we could possibly translate the title of this dharani as the 70 million hearts of the Prajnaparamita. A much shorter version of this case, indeed only the first sentence of what we have in The Gateless Barrier, is also found as case 19 of the Blue Cliff Record, where it simply says, whenever Juju was asked a question, he raised a finger. Here we have the principal matter of the case clearly set forth without the distractions of knives, severed fingers, or the matter of Juju's teacher, Tianlong. Last night I was sitting in here thinking, what a bunch of crazy people we are. Setting about pulling down what's apparently a perfectly good world and replacing it with or top, top, or a knot of wood on the floor, or the touch of our fingers on our hands. But by doing so, finally encountering our own true selves and true reality. To truly encounter this bird call, or this, you know, this talk, or this knot of wood on the floor, is to encounter the vast boundlessness of the universe, which is no other than the vast boundlessness of your true self. total intimacy, boundlessness. And Juju is entirely one of our bunch in our craziness. What is it that Juju was expressing when he raised his finger? This is all that's needed, just this. And I should probably stop right here and not say another word. Because all this talk about the vast boundless universe and the vast boundless self and intimacy and so on and so forth takes us away from just when we chant Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, practicing deep Prajnaparamita, clearly saw, etc., etc. In some ways, in its discursiveness, when it's talking about the Bodhisattva of compassion, practicing wisdom, cutting off pain, in that sense, it's taking us away from that. But there's also a way to work with the chant that brings us back again. And it's simply to chant Ah, Va, Lo, Ki, Te, Shva, La. And if you can chant like that, rather than sitting there and reflecting on the meaning, but just going Ah, Va, Lo, you are there with the bird call, and with the tok, and with the one-fingered Zen of Juju. But sometimes it helps to have explanation and expression. And in this, our teachers and ancestors have been generous, throwing about mud balls with no concern for their own welfare. Yuan Wu, who wrote a commentary on the Blue Cliff Record, said in response to this one-fingered Zen, it is said, as soon as a speck of dust arises, the great earth is contained therein. When a single flower opens, the world immediately comes into being. When you see clearly even the smallest thing, a speck of dust comes forth as the whole universe. There is nothing else. There's a koan, and I'm not sure where it comes from, but if anybody knows, you can tell me afterwards. It asks, what is the largest dharma? And dharma here simply means that which comes forth, this talk, this not on the floor. That which is right now. And one response to this might be that the present dharma is always the largest dharma. But actually, it's neither large nor small, because there is no large and small in essential nature. Large and small belong to the relative world. So whatever is present right now fills the entire universe, annihilating everything else. Indeed, it is the entire universe. Goodbye, world. This is how the universe actually comes forth. Now a speck of dust, now a single flower, now rice in a bowl, now a breath of wind, now pain in the knee. Just this universe of dust mite, flower, wind's caress, the universe of the painful knee. In case 5 of the Blue Cliff Record, Shui Feng addressed his assembly and said, when I pick it up, this great earth is like a grain of rice in size. On our altar there sits an image of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and in his hand he's holding a sword. And this sword, according to Jiajo and others, is the sword that gives life and takes life away. Giving life is the coming forth of things, the speck of dust, the flower, the breeze, the knee. Taking away life is the sweeping away of everything. There is not a single thing that has any continuing existence, that has any substance. Not one thing that is other than transient and impermanent. When that speck of dust arises, there is no teacher, there is no dojo, there is no Goricks, there is no meadow, there is no Sydney, there is no self. So too for the flower, the breeze, the bird call, and so on. When we are truly one with something, truly intimate with that which arises at this moment, everything else disappears. Yamada Roshi, kindly old grandmother that he was, spells it out even more explicitly. When Qianlong sticks up a finger, that one finger is the whole universe. When we stick up one finger, there is nothing but one finger in the whole universe. When you stand up, there is nothing but standing up in the whole universe. When Juju saw Qianlong holding up one finger, he realized clearly that the one finger and the whole universe are one. There isn't anything else that remains. There is nothing outside it. That's enlightenment. So we might say that in many ways, the heart of this case is dealt with in that one sentence. Whenever Juju asked a question, he simply raised one finger. But what about the matter of the young attendant who had his finger cut off? Like other stories in the Zen tradition, for example, Nanchuan's cutting the cat in half, I think I mentioned that the other day, or Yunmen saying to Dongshan, I'll spare you 60 blows, or the sword of General Quan, which I mentioned in my first talk. This can seem disturbingly violent. And how, as people dedicated to non-violence and non-harming, are we to take this apparent violation of the precepts? Aiken Roshi had some wise words on the matter. Such actions, he said, give Zen a bad name in some quarters. Literalists turn to something mild, yet look closely. Read religion as parable, as folklore, as poetic presentation of your own history and nature. Put yourself back on grandmother's ample lap, listening to her read, Jack and the Beanstalk, and you'll shiver again with those awesome words, I'll grind your bones to make my bread. Students ask, did Nanchuan really kill the cat? Well, not just students, it's a sort of perennial question. Did Nanchuan really kill the cat? Did Yunmen really give Dunshan 60 blows? In some ways, these questions are about as helpful as asking whether the giant really did grind the bones of the Englishman to make his bread. Or did the wolf really eat Red Riding Hood's grandmother? As I mentioned earlier, the finger-cutting aspect of this case isn't included in the Bluecliff Records version of the case, but in discussing, Yuan Wu's commentary, he does discuss it, and he gives a pretty much the same account as Wu Men. Juju took a knife and cut off the boy's finger. As he ran screaming, Juju called to him. The boy looked back, whereupon Juju raised his finger. The boy opened up and attained understanding. Tell me, what truth did he see? Are you able to respond to Yuan Wu's question here? What truth did he see? How do you see the mind of the boy here? Let's dig into this a little more. As I've said, when Juju holds up his finger, everything is swept away and the vast empty universe becomes vividly apparent. But what about when the young attendant holds up his finger? Is this the same thing? I think you'll agree that this presentation is quite mundane from the young man's point of view and doesn't convey any genuine insight. He's simply copying what Juju did. And our tradition has quite a lot of stories about copying and people getting caught out, not making their own presentation, but giving another one. For example, in case 54 of the Blue Cliff Record, Yunmen asked a monk, "Where have you come from lately?" Watch out if teachers ever say, "Where did you come from lately?" "From Xichang," answered the monk. "What words does Xichang use these days?" asked Yunmen. The monk stretched out his arms. Yunmen slapped him. "I've something to tell you," said the monk. Yunmen stretched out his arms. The monk said nothing. He was stunned. Yunmen slapped him again. So, when the monk first puts out his hands, you don't know whether this is a true presentation of him coming forth or whether he's just imitating Xichang. But Yunmen pushes it, gives him a slap, see what he'll do. The young monk doesn't come back and just go, "There's something I'm..." Whack! Yunmen often did that sort of thing. A monk said to Yunmen, "The radiance serenely illuminates the whole universe." Before he'd finished the line, Yunmen interrupted him and said, "Aren't those the words of Zhang Zhou?" The monk said, "Alas, the alas is mine." "Yes, they are," Yunmen said. You have misspoken. Whose words were they? "The radiance serenely illuminates the whole universe." Whose words are they? "The radiance serenely illuminates the whole universe." And I mentioned on the first day that, remember in Wu Men's commentary where it says, "You'll walk hand in hand with all the ancestral teachers, your eyebrows entangled with theirs, seeing with their own eyes, seeing with their eyes, hearing with their ears." And I said, it's not saying that you will hear like them. You'll hear like the ancestors. It's not comparing you to the ancestors. It's saying you will see with the eyes of the Buddha. You will hear with the ears of the Buddha. No comparative like this, like that. So the boy copies him, holds up his finger, and Juju cuts it off. You might say that in doing so, Juju wields that sword that gives life, that arouses the coming forth of things, in this case, extreme pain. When that finger was cut off, can you imagine what that was like for the boy? There was no trace of imitation left at that point. No hint of copying. There was just the searing pain. And at that moment, the boy is thrown violently back onto his own experience. And he runs screaming from the room, blood dripping on the floor. And just as he's about to leave, Juju calls to him. He turns, and Juju raises the finger. Now Juju wields the sword that gives death, the sword that takes away everything and allows the empty world to appear. At that moment, the young attendant realizes the unborn, that which neither arises nor falls away, that which is beyond raising and beyond cutting off. When he was about to die, Jujie addressed his monks and said, "I received this one finger Zen from Tien Nung. I used it all my life, but never used it up." When he was a young monk, Jujie lived alone in a little hut where he practiced Zazen. And one day, a nun called True World came to his hut. When she got there, she walked straight in, and without taking off her bamboo hat, she walked three times around Jujie, who was sitting doing Zazen in his meditation seat. "If you can say something," she said, "I'll take off my hat." Sometimes the beginnings of Dharma exchanges are not obvious, as when in the case 15 of the Gateless Gate, Yunmin says to Dungshan, Shouchu. Now, that's not Dungshan Liangjie that we chant in our sutras, but a later Dungshan. He says, "Where were you most recently?" And as I said, you know, when teachers ask you, "Where were you? Where have you come from?" Those sort of questions, you've got to be ready for something. Dungshan says that he was first at Chadu and then he was at Baozi Monastery and completely misses the fact that Yunmin isn't sitting there just idly chatting away about what he's been doing recently. Not just exchanging pleasantries, but he's testing his understanding. Yunmin's response is fierce. First of all, he says, "I'll spare you 60 blows." And then Dongshan goes off, and it's quite interesting. He comes back and says to Yunmin, "You know, yesterday you said you'd spare me 60 blows, and I don't really know what I did wrong." You know, and it's actually a very nice response. It's a sort of very humble response. You know, the result of that, he just comes back and says, "What did I do wrong?" Brave too. Mm-hmm. And Yunmin says, "You rice bag, do you go about in such a way, now west of the river, now south of the lake?" And with this, we're told, Dongshan had great satori. But in the case of Jujie, the nun's monks are clearly not chit-chat, but the opening gambit of the Dharma exchange. Jujie is being tested here. If he speaks, True World will stay. If not, she won't even bother to take her hat off. This is one of those, unfortunately, all too rare occasions in our records where a woman challenges a monk, and you might say, defeats him. Another woman that is very famous is the rice cake seller who met Dishan on the road. Dishan at that point was a famous Diamond Sutra scholar, and he carried his Diamond Sutra around in a cart, which he pulled along behind him. And the woman obviously said that, and saw this, you know, and so he comes up and wants his tea and his cake, and she says, "Your Reverence, it says in the Diamond Sutra, it is not future mind, it is not present mind, it is not past mind. If you can tell me with which mind you're going to eat this cake, I'll freely give you the cake, if not, not." And he too is defeated, he can't say a word. Sabana and I were just talking about this before we came in, and she said something very interesting about it. It's as if Jujie is sort of stuck there in the empty world, and this woman called True World comes in to challenge him. And he can't step out of that empty place and engage with the true world. Or you might even say engage with the feminine side of his own nature. It's a very interesting story, and Savannah was telling me there are, you know, various things, quite a number of things have been written about it. But here she is going around on pilgrimage, sort of, you know, challenging people, looking for people with a clear Dharma eye against which to test her own insight. And Dushan, a bit later than the rice cake episode, after he had met Lungtan shortly afterwards and had a realization experience, he became a very sort of vigorous and powerful young monk, going around the place testing people. And he came to Guishan's temple, and you know, Guishan is one of those really great Tang masters. And he too, he walked in, and he didn't take off his hat, and he didn't take off his travelling garments. He didn't do, you know, the proper thing of sort of putting his hat away and putting his monk's robes on. And he walked across the hall from east to west, and from west to east, saying, "Moo, moo, moo, moo." And he walked up. And he reached and went out, set off, reached the gate of the monastery and said, "Hold on, there's no point in being in a hurry here." So he went back again, and assuming a very dignified manner, he entered and looked around, and this time Guishan was in his seat. And so Dushan spread his meditation mat and said, "Your reverence." Guishan reached for his whisk, but before he could pick it up, Dushan said, "Ho!" Flourished his sleeves. He then turned his back on the Dharma hall, put on his foot gear, and went away. So here was a genuine Dharma exchange where something happened. You might say that that Dushan's behaviour was rather immature. I mean, he was the action of a brilliant but still rather green young man at that point. And I just invite you to notice the different feel between that sort of going about on pilgrimage and meeting people and this encounter between Juju and True World. So she comes in once, she walks around and says, "If you can say a true word, I'll take my hat off and stay." But he was unable to speak. He was unable to step out into that engagement with true world. So she generously then circumambulates his seat another time and stands in front of him and says, you know, she gives him another chance. "If you can say something, I'll take off my hat." But he's still unable to speak. So at this point, she walks out and continues on her way. But then Juju got up and went to the door and called after her, "It'll be late soon. Why don't you stay?" Interesting. He did actually say something. The nun replied for the third time, "If you can say something, I'll stay." But he was once again unable to speak. So, here we've got Juju sort of stuck in emptiness, perhaps sort of stuck in ideas of what he should be doing as a monk, perhaps feeling that any response he made wouldn't have been good enough. I mean, you know, but definitely sort of stuck there. He couldn't even manage to say, "Why don't you sit down and have a cup of tea?" Which would have been a fine response. In fact, as I said, you know, I think his response of, "It's getting dark, why don't you come back?" is a perfectly fine response, but he himself didn't actually realize it. But I'm sure True World did. But she wants to make sure, so she asks him again. And he still can't say anything. So in a way, he's sort of like the monks who were confronted by Nanchuan, who said, you know, when he was about to kill the cat, and says, if one of you can say an appropriate word, I'll spare the cat. No one can say anything. He's like those monks. He's unable to act freely and naturally. And this is a danger that we all face. You know, it's all too easy to get caught up in ideas about, you know, whether our practice is good enough, with being obsessed with following the schedule and getting everything right and all these sorts of things, turning opportunities for discovery and for practicing freedom and liberation into anxieties and snares. And, you know, we're not here to judge either ourselves or others. We're just simply here to be with what is, to be on the vast empty ground and to act freely and naturally. When the bell rings, we come to the dojo. Juju was greatly disappointed by and discouraged by his failure at this exchange, and so he resolved to pack up his belongings and set out the next day on pilgrimage himself, visiting teachers and asking instructions. I mean, this shows some character, don't you think? Faced with his failure, and, you know, I sort of have the feeling that it would be no small thing for a monk in China to have a woman walk in and confront like that and to fail. He could have so easily just gone for that woman. But he didn't, you know. He didn't fall into self-pity or dismissal or recrimination. And then he didn't sit around beating himself up. He resolved to do something. However, on the night that he was about to set out, the deity of the mountain appeared to him in a dream and said, "You don't have to leave. Tomorrow a flesh and blood bodhisattva will come and expound the truth for you. You don't have to go." And as it happened, Master Qianlong came to the hermitage. Juju welcomed him and gave him a full account of his encounter with the nun. Qianlong lifted one finger. Juju was suddenly enlightened. And, you know, Savannah was saying yesterday, there's so many of these stories where X happened and suddenly the monk was enlightened. But there's always a sort of backstory. And it's interesting that Yuan Wu, you know, who in the 13th century wrote the commentaries on the Blue Cliff Record, actually says, "At that time, Juju was most earnest and single-minded, so the bottom of the bucket fell out easily. Whenever anything was asked, Juju just raised one finger." But Yuan Wu acknowledges that work that has been done, his earnestness and his single-mindedness. It's not that the realization comes out of, you know, no practice. You might wonder how it was that Juju could teach using this one device, but honestly, what more do you need? Yuan Wu mentions that the ancient teachers were often like this, back in the good old days, you know, when things were really good. Actually, I suspect that every teacher who gives Taisho on this case has been tempted to just raise up their finger and walk out of the hall. And this would strip everything back to the bare essentials. But it might not be appropriate for this community here or that community there. But it would certainly avoid complicating matters with explanations and theories. Yuan Wu says, "Generally, people these days are not this way, that is like Juju. They indulge in conceptualization and emotional interpretation and don't understand what is most essential with these ancients." And he mentions other old masters who are like this as well. For example, one teacher who was known simply as the earth-beating teacher, who used to hit the ground with his staff whenever anybody asked him a question. Ask him any question. So one day, someone came and hit his staff. And then came up to him and said, "What is Buddha?" And the old man just opened his mouth. Well, if people in Yuan Wu's time were not like this, what about today? Just for fun, I thought it would be interesting to have a look on the web to see what forms of indulgence and conceptualization and theories there are around today. And I can tell you, if you look up this case on the web, you'll find some real doozies. But here's a couple of things that people said they thought. I mean, it's amazing. You have these, you know, these lines of what do you call them when people sort of make comments on things? You know, these
threads.
These threads, yeah, these extraordinary threads of people talking the most incredible and quite hilarious nonsense. So one of them said, "When you lose the most important thing, that means that." Sorry. Maybe when you lose the most important thing that means enlightenment to you, maybe that's when you really become enlightened. So what do you think of that? Is there any hint of understanding there? I think the idea is sort of somehow that, you know, the finger meant enlightenment, and if you chopped it off, somehow, you know, that would reveal nothingness. which is something I've heard on other occasions people say about this game, but I don't think that's right. Another person said, "Stories like this make me want to lash out. Gute became the enlightener when maybe he should just lighten up." Now we know the reason for lawyers: to sue crazy old self-appointed wise men that carry pocket knives. Women's comment. "The enlightenment of Juju in the boy has nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Qianlong, Juju, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with a single skewer." Why does it have nothing to do with the end of a finger? Again, Yamada Roshi, being grandmotherly once more, spells it out. The finger was merely the medium. Shakyamuni attained his great realization when he saw the twinkling star of Venus in the eastern sky. Kyogen came to realization when he heard the sound of a small pebble bouncing against bamboo. The pink blossoms of distant peach trees triggered Rayon's sight into true sight after 30 years of hard practice. So in contemplating this case, we shouldn't become fixated on fingers. Remember, when Juju presented his finger to the boy, he did not so much present a finger as that which cannot be cut off. Women's verse. "Qianlong made a fool of old Juju, who cut the boy with a sharp blade." How did Qianlong make a fool of Juju? Some people say that this was because he duped him into always raising a finger whenever he was asked a question. Is that foolish? Well, maybe it would be on a mundane level. I mean, if we went around raising a finger every time anybody asked us a question, it would be a pretty silly thing to do. But that's not the point. Aiken Roshi used to say that Qianlong made a fool of us because in the end, there's really no need for any of this, let alone all the talk that it's generated. Even by just raising his finger, Qianlong stirs up waves where there is no wind. He simply muddies clear waters. The great way comes forth intrinsically perfect and complete. Why add the complication of fingers and explanations? Just as the deity Zhu Ling raised his hand, and Huashan with its many ridges split in two. Zhu Ling was the deity of the mountain Huashan, and according to Chinese legend, Huashan blocked the course of the Yellow River and caused flooding in the country upstream. In order to prevent this, Zhu Ling split the mountain in two. This couplet is saturated with metaphor. On the one hand, by splitting the mountain, Zhu Ling creates two out of one. And this is indeed raising waves where there is no wind, creating muddying waters, creating the world of dualities, birth, death, right, wrong, large, small, out of essential oneness. If Qianlong is making fools of us all simply by raising a finger, what about all this droning on for the last 40 minutes? At the same time, the act of raising the hand to smash the mountain, like the raising of one finger, smashes the mountains. As Yamada Roshi says, when one finger is held up, the essential world appears, annihilating all delusions. Everything falls away, and the vast and unstoppable river breaks through.